Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, now in Season 9. But before we begin, we openly acknowledge that we live and work in Shkrepakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Shkrepak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory for our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, today we are welcoming back two guests who, between them, have many decades of important experience in the world of food and who, in today's turbulent world, will be sharing that important knowledge and understanding with us. Kent Mullenix is director of the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University, based in Surrey, BC, and other parts of the Lower Mainland. And John Eichard is a former professor of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri and author of 6 books on food and farming. And just to give you a clue about their subject matter, 4 out of the 6 have sustainable or sustainability in the title or subtitle. So John and Kent, let me extend a warm welcome to both of you as you join us once again for Food Conversations.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yes, good morning, Warren. Glad to join you all.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you here. Now, you've both been involved in the world of academic research and teaching and some considerable amount of practical experience with growing food. And you've both known each other for a long time. And I forgot to ask you when we were talking beforehand, when did you guys first come across each other? Because you have so many things in common with your professional careers and your approach to food and food production. So Kent, do you remember a first moment when John emerged on the horizon?
I do, actually. And I'll preface this by saying that John has been a tremendous influence on my thinking and my professional development. And I'm grateful for the work that he has done and the way he's gone about doing it and the way he shared it with people, not to embarrass you, John. I first met John through his writing and reading much of what he has put forth and met him indirectly in conferences and when he was speaking. But John, I don't know if you remember this. We first met in person in Toronto at the International Society for Horticultural Science gathering around sustainable food systems. Mm-hmm. And you gave I was one of the conveners and you gave a keynote presentation. And we subsequently published a paper collectively with all the other speakers. And that was back in, the 80s, I think.
Well, John, now's your chance to say, yes, I remember every moment of that encounter.
Well, let me tell you what I remember most, Kent. And I know we've met before that, but I remember being in Wenatchee, Washington. And when they were showing the documentary Broken Limbs, We were in the audience there with the people that were in that Broken Limbs video, that documentary about, you know, what was happening to the apple industry when it was corporations were coming in and taking it over. And I remember being in the audience with people that were in that video, and you were very much a part of that conference there. And I always remember that conference. I thought, well, gee, that's kind of the high point of my career. And it was 25 years ago.
Yeah. Well, thanks for reminding me of that. Yeah. I remember that. It was one of the highlights of my career as well.
So both of you have depth of experience. And one of the reasons to have you both on the show and have you together is that I think the congruence between things that you've each been doing your professional activities will come through and also reflect on the whole subject of where food production and distribution is going. Now, both of you had similar encounters with the so-called dominant paradigm, if we're going to call it that. It's still dominant, but it's fading. I think we have evidence for that, too. Industrial agriculture, the large-scale agribusiness, and both of you moved into other approaches, And it wasn't always an easy thing. There were challenging and at times disturbing circumstances. So if each of you could just encapsulate sort of the moment when you started to diverge from bigger is better, productivity over all other qualities. So Kent, do you remember a sort of spark that was lit in you at some point when you said, this is not going the way I think it should?
I don't know that I can pinpoint a specific time, Warren, but my spouse and I lived and worked on a family farm in central Missouri when we were in graduate school, and during and that would have been in the mid 80s, and during a significant market adjustment, and they lost their 250 acre farm, and during the time that we lived and worked there, and they lost their farm, we had to help them sort things out and get ready for auction, the classic farm auction. And these dedicated, skilled farmers had to leave their farm and go retire in Minneapolis, and that was the first taste I had of a sense of something's not right here, because these are good farmers. They're dedicated to stewarding the land and producing good food, but they can't make it. And then, as John mentioned, in my work in Wenatchee, Washington, 2 decades later, the in another market adjustment, many very good family farmers growing tree fruit there lost their farms, the very best farmers, the innovators, the leaders, but they couldn't make it economically. And the in between those two occurrences, I began thinking, what's not right here? Because this shouldn't be happening the way it's happening. And then I also was aware, became increasingly aware of the environmental transgressions that industrial agriculture was fomenting. And so the social economic occurrences, coupled with the ecological environmental impacts, really just spurred my interest in this concept of sustainable agriculture and food systems.
Well, that word will be heard more than once today on the show. It's
Yeah,
already heard
and
a
that's
few
when I
times.
started reading John Eichard's stuff.
And then you were lost to the new way of looking. Well, it's actually not even new. It's an ancient way of looking at things. So, John, do you remember a trigger? Maybe like Kent, you can't remember an event, but sort of a trigger or a triggering process that led you to say, no, there's something wrong with the.
Very similar in time to what Kent was talking about here. I started out as an advocate of industrial agriculture and as an agricultural economist. That's kind of what we were taught. But the whole idea was, and I think it was well intended, we were going to make agriculture more efficient and more productive. It was going to create profit opportunities for farmers out here. We were going to bring down the cost of production, bring down the cost of food, make good food affordable to everybody. And these profit opportunities for farmers would create strong and vibrant rural communities. And so it's kind of a win-win-win situation. And then, but during the 1980s, I could see in the late 1970s that some things weren't working. But in the 1984, I went from Oklahoma State University to the University of Georgia as head of the Extension Agricultural Economics Department. And it was our responsibility there in our department to go out and work with these farmers and try to help them through this farm financial crisis that they had been caught in. Prices went up, exports in the early 80s, and then the export market dried up. And
The
they had,
market adjustment that Kent was talking about, so-called.
they had huge debts, and those of us that had been talking about, well, you need to get more productive, you need to specialize, standardize, consolidate, get bigger, get bigger, get out. Well, they got big rather than getting out, and they borrowed a lot of money to do it, and then they were caught with these big loans.
Yes.
But the point came when I began to realize, when we were going out and working with these farmers and sit down, we'd have them bring in their records. that it was so-called good farmers that were in the biggest trouble. It was the ones that we had been advising, you know, that this is the future of agriculture, that's what you need to do. I could see that hey, this kind of agriculture wasn't working for farmers. And then I began to see it's not working for rural communities that depend on those farmers. Rural communities were, you know, withering and dying without the family farms there. And then after that, I began to see what the negative impacts were with on the land and the water and the soil with agricultural pollution, biological and chemical waste, and so on. So it just hit me right in the face that, hey, what I've been taught and what I've been teaching, it isn't working. It isn't doing the things that we thought it was going to do. I can't continue doing this any longer.
Well, you know, both of you are almost like auditors of a historical process that was taking place, and both of you saw the same thing. And I think what's impressive about both of you is that you said, we've got to change. This is not working. There's a critical analysis needed of this transformation of agriculture. It's not going in a direction that is, to use that word again, sustainable. Now, because listeners may be starting to say, "Oh my God, I hope there's some hope on the horizon." I came across a book which you actually wrote an introduction for, John. It's called "The Emergent Agriculture," by Gary Kleppel, the New York biologist who now is also retired. But he talked about three conditions that I think may, well, first of all, he said that there is a change back to where we needed to be that we left over the last 30 or 40 years. And what he says is that there are three qualities of what agriculture should be doing. And I was just going to ask each of you to sort of comment. So the first thing he said, agriculture is stable in the face of economic uncertainty. Now, John is an agricultural economist. That's right up your alley. How do you make farming and food production stable in the face of economic uncertainty?
Well, I think what he's talking about here is what I would call kind of one of the three conditions of sustainability. That means it's resilient. It can withstand shocks. And the first thing is to diversify. What we did when we industrialized agriculture, we moved away from diversified farming operation to specializing. That's kind of the first step of industrialization. So when we specialized, we made it more efficient, but we took out the resilience of it. So the first thing I think we need to do is to let's go back and put in the diversity of crop rotations, but integrated crop and livestock systems. Those are much more inherently diverse and much more stable. They're more stable in terms of the ecosystem, in terms of what you're doing. You don't have all your crop growing at the same time, the harvest at the same time. You have different times of the year you're harvesting and planting and things of that nature.
That's
It's also
right.
more
And that's what, and that, of course, is based on the natural model of natural
right.
ecosystems. They're all diverse, and the ones that do best are the ones that are the most diverse.
And it's more economically diverse when you've got several products to sell rather than one. And I
Yes.
think an important point to point out is the only reason that this industrial agriculture model exists today is because basically through farm policy, the taxpayer is absorbing the risk of that industrial system. If all of a sudden you took out government programs supporting this large-scale industrial agriculture, it'd go broke. We saw this during the pandemic, how fragile it is. And then the government had to step in and, you know, kind of salvage the whole
Right.
thing. It would have collapsed. So that resilience is one of the key kind of components of a sustainable system.
Now, the second thing that Gary Kleppel says in his book, Emergent Agriculture, is that systems, growing food systems, need to be resilient in the face of environmental variability. Kent, you live in a province which is a map of micro ecosystems, mountains everywhere, and especially when you get up to the part of the province that I live in. Maybe you could talk about that. The environmental reality has changed so much for growers that unpredictability of weather patterns and extreme weather events have become something that affect just about everybody. How do farmers make their growing practices resilient in the face of up and down weather patterns?
Well, interestingly enough, the same thing that they would do to make themselves economically resilient, diversify, and have mixed model, mixed production farms, and not rely on one cultivar for their cash crop, continue evaluating the adaptability and suitability of different crops and different cultivars of those crops,
right,
and integrate the production systems between all those crops and perhaps livestock and mixed diversified farms.
Yes,
are going to confer resilience to the farm and on a larger food system scale.
The Salmon Arm is a community embedded in what has been for many years a prime growing area. The climate is good, the water supply is good, all sorts of things are helpful. There's lots of flat land in river valleys, etc.
Let me add too, we need to adopt ecologically sound and appropriate production methods.
Yes, indeed.
And we must, and those have to be tailored to the place we're farming.
Yes,
so that's the complement to this diversification.
Yeah, a very important point, the kind of bioregional approach and variability embedded in what's being done. The third point that is present in this book, The Emergent Agriculture, and I think I'll just read it off because it's so obviously true, that the practices of growing agriculture along the line of what you're saying, well, what both of you are saying, must be grounded in stewardship of the land. I don't know how many times people, the farmers here and the all sorts of different growing practices have said, especially organic growing practices, that the land is what helps you. And, you know, if you treat it well, it treats you well. So stewardship of the land, attaching value to food and the craft involved in producing it. I love that notion of craft involved in producing. It's not just, do this, then do that. There's all sorts of subtleties. And on respecting the dignity of farmers, consumers, and livestock, and I would add also plant life forms as well as animal life forms. I don't think anybody can really argue with that
no.
phraseology. It seems to me, John, it seems to me it's like it's the heavens open and a voice says, do this, you fools,
well,
do this.
I think what he's getting at here is kind of the another important dimension of sustainability. What he's getting at here is the regenerative capacity of a farming operation, its ability to regenerate and renew itself. And that's what starts in stewardship of the soil. And, you know, that's where the ultimately sustainability depends upon that solar energy that's coming in. And plants that are in the soil, and healthy, productive soils can regenerate and renew the plants, and then the plants renew the animals and the people. But also, I think what he's getting at is that regenerative capacity depends upon the larger community, on the farmer and the community. And you have to kind of regenerate the knowledge. And he's talking about how you sustain a living system. And that's take care of the soil, take care of the plants, take care of the animals, take care of the people, and so they can continually regenerate and renew. So if you've got a resilient system, a regenerative system, the third dimension is it has to meet the needs of people. That's the fundamental purpose of agriculture.
Indeed it is, very much so. Having eaten food over many years, I can say that works for me. That works very well, and for all of us.
And you know, I would say what he's getting at is it comes down to relationships. What
yes.
you think your relationship is with the land and the plants and the animals and creation, mm-hmm. and what your role in that relationship is. That's what he's talking about.
It's hard to have a conversation like this without getting a little bit excited about the breadth. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you together on the program, because you stimulate each other. John, you were going to say.
Yeah, I think that I agree with what Kent is saying, and ultimately, Sustainability is an ethical or moral kind of decision. There's no economic benefit in making an investment today for the benefit of something in some future generation. You do it because you feel a moral, ethical responsibility toward the future. And there's no social value in that. You won't be here and you don't know anybody here. You do it simply because you think it's the right thing to do. And it's about those relationships, as Ken said, relationships with each other, relationships with the earth, consumers, producers, animals.
There's so much psychological evidence in the psychological literature that the relationships you have with animals and plants condition and interact and reinforce the relationships you have with humans. And if you relate to your fellow humans well, it's because you also relate to the natural world well. It's because you recognize there's this kind of vital energy in everything, including us two-legged creatures that wander the land.
This is the problem with commodifying everything.
Yeah.
It negates the relational dimension.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's something that you are both working to bring back, the relationship, both in your writing and your presentation, but also into teaching. Now, Kent, let's do a little biographical background. You moved to Canada from the United States in 2007, and you brought with it a wealth of experience, which eventually took a while. You got to Kwantlen University, and the work you're doing there now is bringing forward this new paradigm, this new model for growing food, which I think is also a very ancient model because it's based on natural systems. And what's more ancient than they precede humans by quite a bit. Now, in your teaching, what kind of students are you attracting? Who comes to your courses?
I would say, Warren, by and large, those who are already aware that things need to be done differently, those that are already dedicated to some extent or another of advancing human sustainability, and many who are already engaged in the work of doing that. And what they are looking for is more connection, more replete knowledge, to connect all the dots, to create network, to position themselves to be able to pursue a line of work
Yes.
that reflects their commitment to sustainability, just by and large.
They're serious about what they're doing as well.
They are.
But how do you teach them? How much of the teaching that you do is hands-on? How much of it is classroom-based? Is there a mix? What's the basis?
Well, of course, it depends on what we're teaching,
Yes.
but in our programs, when we teach production agriculture, it is predicated on the integration of agricultural science education with experiential
Yes.
education,
And
so that folks can learn by doing and learn how to apply what the science they've been taught. When it comes to the social economic dimensions of our food system, I think perhaps the most significant thing I do, I don't necessarily share new knowledge that I've created, but I think I try to create an environment where the students can engage in discovery, and I try to create an environment that gives them permission to think outside the box, so to speak, and to say those bold things like, this economic system isn't working for just to say those things out
Yes,
loud.
and not be chastised for it.
And then interact with their fellow students and their professors and others to unpack that thinking.
Yes. This sounds like a whole, it's not just a revolution in what the subject matter is, but it's also the approach where the student is recognized as an active participant, not a passive receptacle. There's a conference I go to
Well,
every
I can tell you most of the students I work with are far a lot sharper than I am.
Well, they probably think you're pretty wise and you've been around the
Don't
block a few
know.
times. Now, John, in
Yeah.
your world, you've been literally for about, since you so-called retired, which of course we know is increasingly a meaningless term, about a quarter century ago, you've
Right.
been crisscrossing the United States, speaking and connecting with like-minded people. And just as an illustration of what you've been doing, here's the title of your six books. The first one, The Essentials of Economic Sustainability. Small farms are real farms, sustaining people with agriculture. Crisis and opportunity, sustainability in American agriculture. A return to common sense. Sustainable capitalism, a matter of common sense. And the title that is the most intriguing, I think, is Revolution of the Middle and the Pursuit of Happiness. Now, John, these titles say a lot. I mean, they're very explicit, but could you elaborate a little bit on the revolution of the middle and the
Right.
pursuit of happiness that's entailed in that process?
I focus specifically on it in the U.S., and I could see even when I wrote that book, what, 8 or 5 or 6, no, 8 or 10 years ago, of the Great Divide kind of coming. And I said, we've reached a point where basically our government is dysfunctional in the overall economy. And so what I was talking about in there was trying to get people to return to the basic core values like on which the country is built. When we go back to the Declaration of Independence, it says, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, should have said all humans, are created equal. The foundational core principles that the
Right.
government's to pursue the common good, the public interest, to ensure, you know, blessings of liberty, and not only for ourselves, but for future generations. And I said, we need a revolution of people coming together around the core value part to the left and the right, then we can't come together and do the things that have to be done to sustain the economy, sustain agriculture, and sustain society.
Yeah, there's a certain emphasis on civility and respect for one another that is inherent and also leads, and I notice in many farmers I talk to, there's a sort of a you know, no, it's not like you're wrong. Well, there's an, but it's more like, well, there may be another way to do this. Not you're wrong, but it's another way we can share the fact that we're both struggling to try and figure things out. John?
Now, I think if we could get together and start with the premise, I started with this. I heard this, got this from the Institute of Global Ethics one time, like five kind of core values that people in all different cultures around the world and religions and everything believe in: honesty, fairness, responsibility, compassion, and respect. So if we could come together and say, okay, let's start our conversation by saying we're going to be honest and fair with each other. We're going to be truthful. We're going to be responsible in our relationships, and we're going to be compassionate. We're going to be respectful. And now let's talk about the issues.
Well, we could just stop the show right there. I think we pretty much summed up what human beings ought to be doing on this planet. John, that's lovely. That's lovely. Now, there's another aspect of this, and that is, and it's relational, and that's the role of community and of sharing and of grassroots level change. Not change alone in the legal structures, but in our kind of communities and how they interact. Now, both of you have, when we were talking before the show, you talked about how many examples there are. John, you mentioned one, and it was in the light of developing pilot programs as opposed to changing the whole enchilada all at once. And you mentioned the Denver's Metro Caring program and how successful it was, and yet how governments don't always understand that you foster it at that grassroots level and let it nurture it. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, the thing I was talking about, I really believe that we have to come around and start the transition, start the great transition at the local level with people. And it goes back to, we've really lost our sense of how to get along together with each other at any any level of aggregation, the community, the city, or whatever. And so I feel like that there's a better opportunity if you stick with people within a local community that know each other and care about each other and have some sense of common destiny and common commitment to a particular place. If you start there and start building relationships, then you have a better idea of what you can build up to, and you can network out and things of that nature. And so that's the concept that I was working with the Metro Caring people. We were trying to work out, and we were going to use the idea of using a public utility so that you could establish a community then that would have some insulation from the national and global food market, and you could decide what kind of food you were going to get, who you were going to get it from, how much you were going to pay for it, what you were going to produce, so
Yes.
that you meet the needs of the consumers and people within the community. And so we're starting there. But then when they got to the point where they wanted to get more serious about implementation, then they brought in a consulting firm that was used to working with larger organizations and so on. And then the plan they came up with, and it was well intended, I'm sure, but the plan they came up with would have said, okay, let's provide 100 free food items to everyone in the city of Denver. And I thought, I figured out what that would cost. I said, there's no way the city of Denver is going to do this. You can't get everybody in Denver to agree that people that everybody, regardless of their income, needs free food, whatever. So I saying if you can do this at the community level and you can show how it works and the people can take control of it themselves and manage it themselves and work out the rules themselves, then you can move to another community and another community and another community. But if you try to do it at too large a scale, then you're not going to get it off the ground at all. And so that's kind of where I left it, and I think that's kind of where it still is.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I see certainly projects. We've had consultants in this little town of Salmon Arm come in, brought in by, say, the federal or provincial government. They do an analysis, they convey their findings to everybody, and then that's the end of it. It just dies because they're not saying, well, what do we do tomorrow?
Yeah, I used to have a principal back when I was teaching now and then on campuses and that sort of thing. And I've made the same mistake myself, but I say we often make the mistake of teaching too little because we try to teach too much. And I think we often make the mistake of of doing too little because we try to do too much. We aren't willing to start and just do a little and build on that and do a little bit more and build on that.
We're circling around the notion of values and the values that inspire work and make are the spark that moves things forward. Each of you has your own pet, I wouldn't call it a pet, but your own favorite comment about the world and what you think the important values are. Now, with Kent, yours was to repeat at the end of presentations a line that goes like this: how we gain our sustenance is what determines our humanity. Do you want to, as they say, unpack that a little bit? I mean, it's a wonderful thought, but you have it's a it's something of that you understand and means a lot to you.
Yeah, well, I it it it's it simply seeks I'm the notion seeks to express that we have to eat to fuel our bodies to do all of our work, mental, emotional, spiritual, physical. And we engage in eating many times a day. It's something we fundamentally important to us, and so how we go about doing that vis-a-vis our agriculture system, our food system, our procure all the elements attendant to it is an expression of who we are and what we think it is to be human. And so I think we need to think about this because I think people want to be human in a very different way generally than our agriculture and food system expresses.
Yes,
And
yeah.
in fact, we need to think in these terms, if you ask me, about everything we do. How does this express my humanity?
Yes. And John, your favorite phrase, which you borrowed from John Maynard Keynes, is also echoing what Kent just said, because it's about relationships, and it's live wisely, agreeably, and well.
John Maynard Keynes said that the economic problem would be solved by now. He said it more than 100 years ago. He said within 100 years, the economic problem would be solved. We'll have all the material well-being that we need. And then we can spend our time and effort focusing on the important things of life, which is to live wisely, agreeably, and well. And again, I think this ties in back to the idea of sustainability. So when you say live agreeably, we mean social relationships with each other, get along with each other, have a strong social responsibility. Wisely, or let me get well is economic in terms of continuing to meet our needs materially, and wisely is to live in a way where we are concerned about meeting the needs of everyone in the present, but doing it in such a way that it leaves equal or better opportunities for the future. So we need to be wise in our relationships with each other, wise in our relationships with the earth. But we live agreeably with each other and with the earth, and we live well.
The spirit of the Brundtland Commission coming through.
Right.
I'd like to remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Kent Mullenix, who is the director of the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University, and John Eichard, a former professor of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri and the author of six books on food and farming. I mentioned to you when we were talking before the show that one of the largest owners of food operations in British Columbia is a guy named Jimmy Pattison. And Jimmy Pattison has vast connections with the agribusiness, globalization of the food system process. But recently, he's been doing some unusual things, unusual for him. He bought out two food chains, one called Choices in the southern part of the province, and another one called Nature's Fair, which is in the central part of the province. Both of them emphasize local food, organic food, healthy food. They actually teach classes in their stores, certainly, well, both of them do actually, about how to make the food system work in a healthy way and a more naturalistic way. And we talked about that a little bit, and why would a giant retail food magnate start buying up local stores like this and saying to the owners or the progenitors of these two chains, don't change a thing. I want to buy your stores as is. Now, Kent, you had some things to say about that. I think you're pretty relevant, and why don't you share them today? Why would Jimmy Pattison deviate from his past business model?
Well, the Pattison Group is doing exactly what John and I were talking about farms needing to do. He is diversifying his portfolio. And there's economic resilience and advantage in doing that. Those stores cater to an economic group, a market niche, and he knows that. He bought them because they're lucrative and they complement his other holdings. Pure and
And
simple.
I would advance the notion that 20 years ago he would have thought this is who cares? This isn't necessary. And now he's seeing from his narrow materialistic perspective, he's seeing the new model, and he's saying, well, maybe I can't just pretend it doesn't exist anymore. I'm going to have to participate in my own way, which is to buy them up.
Well, I think I would shift that. I'm going to take advantage of it in my own way and buy
Yes.
them up. I don't know this. I don't know Jimmy Pattison. I don't know the operatives of the Pattison Group, but I doubt that they hold the ethos
Oh, absolutely.
that created those stores. I don't
Yes.
think this is about ethos. This is
No.
other, well, no, it is making money. It's a sound
Yes.
investment.
Yes, and I what the point the only reason for bringing this up is that it's a reflection of the fact that even a hard-boiled capitalist extractivist proponent is now saying in the back of his mind saying, there's this new thing happened. There's a new kid in the block. His own approach is to exploit it for financial reasons, but it's like the writing is sort of appearing on the wall, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, it's very much like the organic movement. You know, 40 years ago, all the proponents of organic were the subculture group, and mainstream food system and agriculture scoffed at them, laughed at them,
Yes.
rebuked them, and now it's the single fastest growing food market segment in the food market, and the mainstream folks are lapping it up.
Yes. John, you've
And
had some.
the folks that are de that were that are and were dedicated to the objectives of organic agriculture are taking it on the chin because they can't
Yes.
compete anymore.
Except when they come to a little town like Salmon Arm, and all the small food growers are starting to say, we don't want the big guys, we don't need them.
Well,
John, you've.
that's exactly right.
Yeah. John, you've had some experiences seeing this same phenomenon taking place, large-scale corporate buyouts of
Right.
nutrients.
I think it's it kind of goes back to what Gandhi said, and I can't remember. First they laugh at you, and then they fight you, and after a
First
while
they
you
ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win.
you win, but in this case then they take you over.
Yeah.
When you have something new like we're talking about here, and it comes on the scene, and they say, "Okay, this is different. We don't want to have to mess with it," and things like that. And if it keeps growing, they say, "Okay, maybe this is going to go away, or maybe we can get rid of it." And when they conclude that finally there's a significant number of people out here that really want this, then they start thinking, "Okay, how can we co-opt it, and how can we integrate it into what we're doing?" And that's exactly what they've been doing with this whole food movement, regardless of whether it's local or organic or whatever. They come around and they say, okay, now how can we integrate this so that the customer or the consumer will think it's the same thing that we started out with in these smaller operations, but we will do it in such a way that it fits into our large-scale, specialized, standardized, mechanized, industrial, computerized model of production or distribution. And once they do that, then they begin to embrace it and say, oh, we're all for it. We want to be involved in this.
Yes.
And they tell the people, no, we don't want you to change anything because we want you to maintain the image, but we'll do the changing in the back door, so we'll come in.
Yes, well, often there is that kind of subtle approach. You know, we won't change anything except 10 years later, you find that if you're not careful, the things have changed.
Right.
And that comes back to this whole idea of how does this process of change take place? And you talk, John, about letting the community, letting neighborhoods, letting small groups bring things forward. And it seems to me that that's, you might say, something that can be understood and taught, this notion that you make community a central feature in what you're doing. Now, you made it clear that, Kent, you made it clear that when this transition to mass, agribusiness took place, it wasn't the result of malevolent intent on the part of researchers and the people who were supporting the science behind growing food, but that people had lost their way, that the intellectual content of teaching and learning had sort of deviated from the norm, if you like, the ancient, the profoundly embedded norm that's part of the natural world. What do you think this process of moving out of this old pattern into this massive mass production pattern, what do you think is the antidote? I mean, we're talking about the antidote, so I'm not, this is kind of going to the same territory again, but in your teaching, what kind of teaching do you do that helps that transition take place back to a more realistic approach?
Well, I'll tell you, Warren, one thing that I've come to accept is that we're not going to beat them directly. And I no longer go up against mainstream agriculture and food system and global industrial actors. I think the answer is very much as John was alluding to, is to work with local actors and build an alternative system that can grow over time and eclipse the dominance of the global industrial system. So the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems is focused on several things. One is supporting small scale community focused farming and food purveyors, processing, value added. We are focused on supporting indigenous communities, advance their food ways, again, community focused. We are programmatically focused on advancing what we're calling bioregional food systems, connecting the food system with with place and significantly the culture and ecology of place. And I think that I'm hopeful that these things will over time, as they gain momentum, add up to an alternate system that can supplant the dominant global industrial system.
I love the term supplant, planting underneath, the Latin would say, planting underneath, sort of lighting a fire underneath the system, and then, well, let's just say incinerating the large scale system.
But it's providing the support and the tools and the knowledge that people need to build this.
Yes,
And that's
yes.
what really what we do. That's what John's been doing for decades.
Yeah, John, add your thoughts to this, because I know this is, as Kent has said, this has been a theme for you and your life and your teaching for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think we have to basically rethink everything. But you're not going to do that all at once. And I think you can do that in the smaller groups. The biggest challenge that we have, even in the small groups, is the, in my opinion, is relationships. We've gotten away from the idea that relationships are important. And the more and more that we've gotten everything that we need and everything we want through impersonal transactions, buying, selling, working, earning money, spending, that sort of thing, and gone away from depending upon each other to meet our basic needs, not just our social needs, but also our material needs, then we've kind of lost the art and the science of relationships. And we've spent a huge amount of money and a huge amount of time on education, even on ecological education about the physical world and relationships in the physical world. But basically, we've done almost nothing about how we build strong human relationships among people. And I think that's the challenge. I say that it's easier to meet that challenge, I think, at the local level, where people at least know each other and they have a commitment to it. But that's going to be the challenge of the future, is rebuilding kind of the art and science of relationships. And I'm a product of it myself. I grew up on a small family farm. My brother's stayed there. My brother was born on the farm, spent his whole life on the farm. He left for 6 months in the military, and he died on the farm. And he was a part of that community and a part of that land. And I've just wandered around like Kent has all over the country. And you that's not conducive to building strong relationships when you got people just moving around from here and there and everywhere else. So we just need to focus on how do we get along with each other? How do we make commitments so that we can take on something that's more than just, well, as long as I can get food cheaper from this, I'll do it and then I'll quit. That's just not going to work. We have to have long-term relationships. But I think it's doable. There's a part of us that says that's important to our quality of life. And so I think
Absolutely.
it's doable.
Absolutely. I belong to a profession where it's all about relationships, and we're not doing as good a job as we should be doing either in the medical field, and yet it's all relational. Now, a key tool for enhancing relationships, I think we should talk about the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. Now, listeners may not be familiar with this publication, but when I came across it a few years ago, all sorts of little sparks started to take off in my mind. Kent, why don't you talk about it? Both of you've had some engagement with it, and it's played a role not just in your lives, but in the lives of many people who are thinking about the kind of things we're talking about today. Kent, what are your thoughts about that journal and what role it's playing?
Well, the KPU has been a university sponsor of the journal since its inception, pretty much. And I've been on the advisory group and editorial board for a long time. But it's a journal that is intended to accomplish some things that are quite different from most journals. First, it seeks to bring folks in the academics together with community activists and get them sharing information and talking to one another and interacting with one another. It's a journal that emphasizes what they call accessible writing and academic work.
Yes.
It's also the world's first open access, cooperatively financed journal.
Yes.
And so there are no publication fees associated with it and those kinds of things. So it's a journal that's absolutely trying to make information accessible broadly. And then finally, it's dedicated to publishing material that is very broad in its focus and subject matter and brings together really a diversity of subjects, because agriculture and our food system and community is it's a broad subject, and we know that there are aspects of our food system and our community and agriculture that intersect with many other dimensions of those same things. I think that's about it, John. Is that
John,
pretty close?
you just wrote another piece for it, and you used to do a column in
I'm still doing a column. I've been doing a
the
column for
pamphlet.
more than 10 years,
Yeah.
11, 12. Anyway, they came to me and they asked me if I'd be willing to write a column for them, just a short piece, anywhere from 1,000, 2,000 words, to go in each issue if I wanted to do it. And they basically said I could write on whatever I wanted to write on. And I chose the name for my column of the Economic Pamphleteer, and it was purposely after Thomas Paine, who was the
Sure.
pamphleteer back during Revolutionary War days. And
A noble profession being a pamphleteer.
I'm a big fan of Thomas Paine because it went through his writings. He always had kind of a pattern. He would talk about how bad things were, and I thought, well, it's just kind of what we're talking about, sustainability. You talk about the problem. That's what he was talking about with the monarchy and this sort of thing. And then he would talk about how great it would be if we changed what we're doing now to changing something else, kind of after the revolution. And then he always ended up on a hopeful note saying, well, it's inevitable that ultimately we're going to prevail because it's just kind of common sense that we'll prevail. And I think that's what's reflected in the journal, and that's what I reflect in a column. It's a whole range of things that talk about the problem. They talk about the vision for a new food system, community development, a new economy, and so on. And then they have hopeful articles that say there's some hope of getting there. We can possibly make this transition. And I think ultimately that's what it takes to bring about big changes. You have to realize you've got a problem. Things aren't going to get better unless you do something different, and you're going to have to change. But you have to know what you're going to change to. You have to have a vision of where you want to go from where you are. And then you have to have hope, or you have to believe it's possible to make the transition. So I think that's what I try to reflect in my columns. I think that's what's reflected in the journal.
Yes, and I think it is a wonderful publication for its diversity and its combination of advocacy and research, an intense examination of an issue, and then people talking about the intense examination of an issue and what they're doing about it. We're coming to the end of the show now, and I just want to lay out something that I think summarizes what we've been talking about today and why these issues of community and sharing are so important. The Canadian Alanis Aubumpsawan, she was a writer and an advocate of Indigenous background, Cree background, and she wrote a famous statement that I think everybody is probably familiar with, and certainly the two of you would be familiar with, and it goes like this: "When the last tree is cut down, the last fish is caught, and the last river is polluted, when to breathe the air is sickening, you will realize too late that wealth is not in bank accounts and that you can't eat money." And it seems to me that what we've been talking about today, and I must admit, it's very heartening to have you two guys on the show, is sort of that's the essence of what we're talking about, that we are in relationship all the time, that we are responsible not just for ourselves, but for the well-being of other people. And you two, you both of you, in the work you've done and the work you're doing, and I'm sure the work you'll be heading towards in the future, are exemplars of that kind of mentality, that kind of approach. And I thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for your kind words, and thank you for the opportunity to be here with you.
Likewise, thanks, Warren.